I'm Jean Marie Laskus. I'm a journalist. I spent my career helping Americans understand the lives of other Americans. Coal miners, gun shop clerks, staffers in the White House mailroom. In my new podcast, Cement City, I tell the story of an entire town. A dying town that you have absolutely no reason to care about. But trust me, you will. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From Odyssey, I'm Lauren Berry, and this is the On Deadline podcast, where you get a deeper look at stories from our radio newsrooms across the nation. Today, On Deadline is checking in on our three leading presidential candidates as November grows closer. A Democrat, a Republican, and an independent whose family name has a long history in American politics. Let's start with President Joe Biden. Expected to be the Democratic nominee, the 81-year-old incumbent is facing a variety of barriers on his path to a second term, including his age, shifting demographics, and voter sentiment to how he's handled issues like the economy and the border. At 81, Biden is the oldest serving president, and he'll soon be the oldest presidential candidate ever, breaking a record he set when he ran for office in 2020. A special counsel report from earlier this year dubbed Biden as an elderly man with a hazy memory, sparking outcry from the Democratic Party and forcing Biden's campaign to attempt to show him as more youthful. Despite this, some demographics are still not feeling as confident as they once did in the president. A recent survey showed that he may be losing support amongst Hispanic and African American voters. Polls from Quinnipiac University, The Economist, NPR, PBS, The New York Times, and more have shown that the U.S. could see a massive realignment when it comes to how certain demographic categories vote in 2024. According to the polls, support for Biden's Republican opponent, former President Donald Trump, has jumped by almost 20% among Hispanics and almost 30% among Black Americans when compared to how they voted in 2020. Political analyst Ron Fauché joined Odyssey in New Orleans to discuss recent polls and what they could mean for the president come November.
Ron, there are so many balls in the air that we are juggling right now that could possibly influence this election one way or the other, but the polls don't seem to be moving that much.
No, you know, the polls really haven't moved in quite a while. They're generally showing that President Biden's job rating is in the low 40s, about 40%. And his negative rating is in the mid-50s. None of that's good for him. It also shows that the race between him and Trump is very close nationally. Most of the polls have been showing Trump slightly ahead. And the polls have been showing that Trump is slightly ahead in the swing states. Now, there's some new polls that come out every week, and we have to always be careful we don't jump to conclusions about what any one poll shows. But in recent days, some polling has come out that shows that Trump's small lead in a lot of these key states is actually declined some. So the race is closer than maybe it had been. But, you know, there's a lot that's coming out every day, and it can easily change perceptions.
A big question hanging over the presidential election is President Joe Biden's strength among African-American and Hispanic voters. Two out of five ballots cast for him in 2020 came from these voters. Great analysis. If you would, share it with us.
A lot of talk for some time that the polls are not showing Biden getting the percentage of the vote of African-Americans and Hispanics that he got last time. Now, that's particularly important because the African-American vote is generally is voting for Democratic candidates at the national level to about 90%. And when you got 13% of the electorate voting 90% for your candidate, that's a very important political base, obviously. And of course, both parties have been going after Hispanic votes for some time. And the Democrats, generally speaking, were getting a sizable majority of Hispanic votes, not as big of a percentage as Black voters, but significant. For instance, last time, Joe Biden got 65% of the Hispanic vote and almost 90% of Black voters. The latest polls are showing Biden getting somewhere in the 70s among Black voters, which is, you know, anywhere between 12 and 16% short of what he got last time. And even worse for him is that he's The polls are showing him getting in the mid-40 among Hispanic voters, which is 20% less than he got last time. So there's a lot of concern that the hardcore Democratic base won't be there for him the way it was there for him 4 years ago and the way it was there for Barack Obama twice. And when you actually look at the polling, you can see that there is cause for concern. Now, I interviewed a number of people for this piece, and a local political consultant, a local professor and political analyst who know an awful lot about African-American, politics and voting patterns. And I think the conclusion is that most people, I think, including me, thinks that Biden will ultimately get a high percentage of African-American votes, but the turnout may be lower. And, of course, when the turnout's lower, that's almost as bad as is losing the vote to the opposition. Because many people are not seeing the movement from Biden to Trump among African-American voters that I think some Republicans hope can happen. But there is movement from Biden to Trump among Hispanic voters, and that's going to be a problem. So, when it comes down to it, in a close election, everything matters. Every vote matters. And if the Democratic base of African-American and Hispanic voters don't turn out to the extent that they did last time, that creates a real problem for Democrats nationwide and for Biden's campaign. Now, Democrats tell me, they have time to fix these problems and communicate messages and do what they have to do to get those percentages up. But even though they've talked about that for a while, the percentages haven't gone up. And that's one of the problems that Biden has in general, that the Democrats say, well, we have some new ads and they're great, and the president gives a State of the Union message and seems to do better than he had previously, and they have this issue and that issue, and Trump's got this problem and that problem. But nothing seems to be improving Biden's position. And if your base isn't there to the extent that you need it to be, then you got a big problem.
I'm Jean Marie Laskus. I'm a journalist. I spent my career helping Americans understand the lives of other Americans. Coal miners, gun shop clerks, staffers in the White House mailroom. In my new podcast, Cement City, I tell the story of an entire town. A dying town that you have absolutely no reason to care about. But trust me, you will. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
While support for Trump may be on the rise, so are his legal battles and fees. Just last week, Trump was saved from coughing up a $467 million bond for his New York fraud trial. Instead, Trump was given 10 days to hand over a fraction of the penalty, $175 million. And eventually, he did. Still, the issues for the former president aren't going away soon. He still faces federal charges over his handling of classified documents after leaving office, and his attempts to stop the 2020 election, as well as state charges for an alleged hush money scandal and his interference in Georgia's election in 2020. On top of all of this, Trump was also ordered to pay more than $80 million to author E. Jean Carroll after he was found liable for defamation. So while support may be mounting, Trump's path to the election is littered with challenges. Former Manhattan DA prosecutor Catherine Christian joined Odyssey to discuss last week's ruling and why it wasn't a total win for Trump.
The bond amount was based on the judgment. He was ordered by the judge, because he lost that civil fraud trial, to pay, they call it disgorgement, when you're basically, it's not a fine, you're paying back for your alleged unjust enrichment of $464 million, which is a half a billion. So he either had to put up, bond in that amount or the actual cash. And what his lawyers did is they went to, we call it here, the appellate division. So the appellate division is the appellate court, and said, look, we want you to stay enforcement of this bond, or at a minimum, our client can put up $100 million. The appellate court said, you know what? We're going to stay enforcement of the judgment, including, ordering that you have to pay the $464 million, long as you post $175 million and you perfect your appeal within 10 days. So people saying it's a win-win-win. He won the battle for now in that he didn't have to come up with a bond, which he had no money to do. So it's a completely legitimate decision. I heard someone, a talking head today, a lawyer who does not practice in Manhattan or New York, talk about this appellate court being pro-business, which is just laugh out loud. I saw the five names of the judges who made this decision. It's usually a panel of five people, and they are as far away from the right as you can be. So I think what the appellate court did in this case was say, look, where is Donald Trump going to go? He can't hide. We're taking $175 million of his dollars, which now is going to be in escrow. He can't sell any of his properties. Why? Because there's a former federal judge who has been appointed as a monitor for the Trump Organization, and they can't make any financial maneuvers without her say-so. So I think that's what the appellate court was doing. They weren't going to just rubber stamp what the attorney general wanted. They were being what they would perceive as being fair. And they would do this whether it was Donald Trump or Joe Blow. And again, $175 million is a lot of money.
Where do you come down in this debate over Trump and a two-tiered system of justice? Of course, Trump himself and his supporters say that he's victimized and being the victim of abuse, political and legal abuse. And on the other side, people have said that actually he's nobody could get away with delaying and kind of squirming out of various punishment and penalties. Anyone other than Donald Trump would not have been this successful. Where do you land in all that?
Well, I'll land with this. Just forgetting is Trump. People with money do better in the justice system because you get to hire the best attorneys there are. I'm not blurring assigned counsel at all, who work very hard and do a very good job. So you just forget that it's Trump. Just someone with lots of resources, financial resources, gets to do that. And in terms of, I do defense work. Delay is a legitimate strategy. You don't want your client to go to trial, and you will file every motion that you can to avoid that. Now, he was unsuccessful doing that on the civil. Remember, he's had three trials that he's lost. He's lost the civil case against Jean Carroll, that defamation rape case. And he wasn't found liable of rape, but he was found liable of sex abuse. He lost the other defamation case, $91 million he had put up for bond. And he lost the civil fraud case. So those cases went. The criminal trials, the delays, you can say the Georgia delay has been because of that unfortunate kerfuffle about, the DA and the person on her staff that she was engaged in a romantic relationship with. So that caused a delay. The federal election interference case, these were legitimate appeals to the Supreme Court. That's a delay, but that's legitimate. The Supreme Court took it. And the classified documents case, well, I have no comment about that particular judge moving very slowly. So there's nothing that his attorneys have done that's illegal or out of the ordinary in terms of advocating on behalf of your client. Now, what I do think is unusual from my experience, that a person who has four open felony indictments in four different jurisdictions, there would have been bail set on one of them. And he is not out on bail on any of them because no bail has been set. Now, on the other side of that is, again, where is he going to hide? Part of the reason for bail is to make sure the person returns to the court. He's not going anywhere. Even with his private jet, he's not fleeing to another country. So if you look at it that way, there's nowhere he's going to hide. So you know he's going to return to court.
Last up is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who may become one of the most disruptive independent candidates of all time. Although the verdict is still out on whether he'll pull more votes from Biden or from Trump, Kennedy is joining the ranks of former President Teddy Roosevelt, who ran for a third term in 1912 as a member of the infamous Bull Moose Party, and independent businessman Ross Perot, who in 1992 was the last third-party candidate to poll as high as Kennedy does now. Now the longtime Democrat turned independent is looking to win the White House as a third-party option after finding little support in his former party. One thing that contributed to RFK's split from the party his family is associated with is his anti-vaxxer sentiment. It saw him banned from Instagram, too. He's also made headlines for alleged anti-Semitic remarks, some head-scratching conspiracy theories, and more. Kennedy made a splash last month when announcing his running mate, Nicole Shanahan, a tech attorney and entrepreneur. But while some have said he should drop out, as not to steal votes from Biden in favor of Trump, RFK says he's running for Americans who deserve more than, quote, the lesser of two evils. Last week, before he made his announcement, RFK joined Odyssey to share more about his campaign.
But why now at 70 at this point in your life?
Well, it's not something, Doug, that I intended to do. I was not, you know, preparing myself for a presidential run. I toyed with politics. You know, I've been involved in politics my whole life, you know, involved in electoral politics at every level. And I toyed with running myself a couple of times. I came very, very close. But, you know, as you pointed out, it's a young person's game. And, you know, particularly if you're going to run for lower office like the Senate, you need to be there before you get a chairmanship for, you know, 12 to 18 years. So if, sometime in my early 60s, I just said, this is no longer on the plate anymore. And I you know, I love my life, and I love litigating against polluters and leading, you know, the battle for clean water, clean air, and clean energy and all the things that I was doing. But I just saw our country taking a wrong turn and the Democratic Party being part of that, driving that. I saw the Democratic Party depart from the party that I was raised with, which was a party that was very anti-war, very skeptical towards corporate power. It was on the side of the middle class, the working poor. It was opposed to big pharma, big agriculture, the Wall Street banks, the Fed, all of these, you know, the masters of the universe, the corporate titans that now have captured our public agencies and turned them predatory against the American public. And it was for free speech and adamantly against any participation by the government and the censorship of American speech. And now the Democratic Party is has walked away from those traditional values. I would say to you, if you took all of the priorities that my father had, that my uncle had, President Kennedy, and listed them, I would check every one of those boxes. But I don't think the current Democratic Party is doing that. And now, you know, we're in a crisis situation like nothing we've ever seen before.
I know you're in this to win it. You don't like it when people characterize you as a spoiler, but how will you feel if you don't win enough votes to become president, but you do draw enough Democrats and moderate independents so that President Trump gets another 4 years? What would that mean for your agenda and the things you believe in?
Well, you know, I don't think that, first of all, this is a three-way race, and you know, I intend to win the race, and I intend to win, take votes from President Trump and President Biden. Now, people I don't think Americans should be talked into, you know, voting for somebody out of fear. And you know, the interesting thing about President Biden supporters is they rarely talk about his record. They, you know, are not trying to amplify his voice. They're instead trying to stoke fear in the American people. The only thing you hear from them is vote for President Biden or else President Trump's going to get elected. And really, both of those men are going to bring us the same thing. They're the ones who brought us the $34 trillion debt. They're the ones who brought us the war machine. President Trump, as I said, said he was going to end the war machine, but he did the opposite. They're the ones who brought us the corporate capture of our agencies. President Trump said he was going to drain the swamp, but he brought John Bolton in and Scott Gottlieb to run FDA and Alex Azar. His entire government was lobbyists from the most rapacious corporations in the country. So, you know, that the two of those men drove the biggest debt, a higher debt between them than all the presidents before them combined. Oh, if you want more of the same, vote for Trump or Biden. They're trying to scare people into voting for, you know, scare people about their opponent instead of saying, here's what I did when I was in office. I think we need, if we want something different, we need to derail that great corporate gravy train, but that both of them are piloting. And they both had 4 years, and they've just made the situation worse. And I think it's time for Americans to vote out of hope. You know, I have the best favorability rating of any political candidate in our country, the highest favorability rating, one of the lowest unfavorability ratings. Oh, Americans would like to vote for me. 70% of Americans say they don't want to vote for President Trump or President Biden, but they're going to hold their nose and vote out of fear. I don't think that's what our democracy our exemplary democracy is supposed to mean to the rest of the world. I think we should, Americans should vote for somebody they like, somebody who gives them some hope for the future of our country. And, you know, I want to give them that chance and not just, you know, withdraw and see people vote out of fear.
Here's where things sit. Polls that offer Kennedy, Biden, and Trump as candidates in a hypothetical election find that Trump leads with 41.5%, followed by Biden at 39.1% and Kennedy at 9.9%, according to the Hill Decision Desk HQ Polling Index. That means a path for victory would require Trump to hold on to the votes he has, while Biden will need to convince voters that he has the country headed in the right direction, regaining their support. As for RFK, the independent will need to pull from Trump and Biden's base in order to win his long-shot bid, something he still maintains is possible. This show is produced by Joe Heedy, Christy Strouser, and Myron Kaplan. And by me. I'm Lauren Berry, and I want to say thanks for listening to On Deadline, Odyssey's serving of a top news story just for you. Subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts to stay informed.
This is Jean Marie Laskus with the podcast Cement City. So there's this election coming up, a big one, and one guy's been indicted. People are talking voter fraud. Democracy itself is on the line. Sound familiar? Well, this isn't that election. This one is in Denora, Pennsylvania, a dying town in the middle of nowhere, where I bought a house and stayed for 3 years. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.